BBC News at 10 o'clock. Boris Johnson has been elected for a second time as Mayor of London. He beat his Labour rival, Ken Livingstone, who's bowing out of frontline politics, by 62,000 votes. The Liberal Democrats were pushed into fourth place by the Greens. Mr. Johnson's victory bucks a trend of heavy losses in the local elections for the Conservatives and their coalition partners. The Home Secretary, Theresa May, said that despite the defeats, the government would stick to its deficit reduction programme.
We will carry on doing what we believe to be right for the country. Of course, these are very difficult times. We realise that these are tough times for people up and down the country. But what I believe is right as a government is that we carry on making the decisions that are right for the country. And we've got to deal with this deficit, and we've got to deal with the situation in our economy.
The man accused of masterminding the September the 11th attacks faces formal charges in a military tribunal at Guantanamo Bay. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is accused of planning and executing the attacks in New York, in Washington, and in Shanksville in Pennsylvania, killing a total of 2,976 people. The trial raises the controversial interrogation techniques of the Bush era. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was reportedly waterboarded 183 times in just 1 month. Power workers have begun switching off Japan's last working nuclear reactor. The Tomari plant in northern Japan is the last of more than 50 reactors that have been closed since the tsunami last year caused a devastating meltdown at Fukushima. A large study has found that fertility treatment raises the risk of birth defects in babies. On average, defects were present in 8.3% of pregnancies that involved fertility treatment, compared with 5.8% in natural pregnancies. The report by Australian scientists is published in the New England Journal of Medicine. When the authorities in Malaysia heard hissing at Penang Airport, they opened a container and found more than 550 cobras and 170 turtles. The creatures, hidden among papayas, were destined for cooking pots in Hong Kong. They've been taken to a zoo. BBC News.
An age of elegance.
There's a marble swimming pool.
An age of decadence.
There are 40 acres of lawn and garden.
A classic of American literature.
The mansion of Mr. J. Gatsby.
F. Scott Fitzgerald's portrait of the fallibility of the American dream.
I don't want you thinking I'm just some nobody. I'm actually the son of wealthy people in the Middle West.
Starring Andrew Scott.
You're Daisy Buchanan's cousin.
That's right.
I'm Gatsby.
The Great Gatsby, BBC Radio 4's new classic serial, starting tomorrow afternoon at 3.
Welcome back to the new extended Saturday Live with Sian Williams and Richard Coles. Coming up, we hear from John McCarthy going underground in the Paris Metro, and we have the inheritance track for the magnificent Cilla Black. But first, I remember as a small boy writing a letter to Benjamin Britten, asking for his advice on how to become a great violin virtuoso. He kindly replied, and so encouragingly, I felt guilty for bailing out at grade 3 ever since. Andrew Buckingham, however, had a happier experience when he was 13 and wrote a fan letter to the waspish and not always approachable Kenneth Williams. He too got a reply, and after a bit of persistence, the two became regular pen pals. Andrew joins us now. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning.
What inspired you, or should I say nerved you, to write in the first place to Kenneth Williams?
I guess partly because I've always been certainly quite an eccentric, weird child, and because I grew up with Kenneth Williams.
Joined the club.
Oh, no, Jack and Nori, when he was reading James and the Giant Peach, for example. Mm. The Carry On films, obviously being quite young, a lot of the jokes went over my head. And I was entranced by his voice, and he came across very intelligent, slightly dangerous, a bit edgy, and I thought, I'm going to write to him and get a signed photograph. Photograph came back with a letter, which I wasn't expecting. I replied, and I think I got a reply, and then there was a bit of a hiatus after a few months, and then I got back into it, and then there was this wonderful ping-pong of letters over the next 2.5 years.
So you developed a proper sort of pen-pal relationship with someone who initially had just written for a sort of letter of supplication asking for a signed photo.
Yes, yes, it was amazing. I mean, the collection spans from January 1985 to, I think, March 1988, so 3 years and 31 letters.
I mean, you've brought it in, and it's been rather beautifully bound.
Mm, thank you.
And the first thing that strikes me about it is it's what I imagine if you got a letter from E.M. Forster it would look like. It doesn't look...
Yes.
I mean, Kenneth Williams' reputation as being this sort of caricature almost of himself, that's not the personality that comes over when you look at these letters, which are beautifully elegant.
And... Yes, all beautifully written in blue fountain pen, and obviously he trained as a draftsman, so he's got that wonderful letter left, straight left margin, beautiful sense of order.
I love that.
Yeah,
my father had the same.
He put so much effort into the letters, and I mean, the topics covered everything, the carry-ons and his health and his mother.
I have a very interesting take on it because I get a lot of letters. What was your initial intent? Your connection with him because he was different and you felt different. I get that. Was your intent to meet him? Was your intent to get involved with him somehow, be a friend of his?
Yes.
What was your intent?
I never...
Did you know what it was?
No, not really. I wanted to, I think I wanted to make some sort of connection, but I never, it would never have crossed my mind to have ever met him, although I thought at one stage I was going to.
So you never did?
No, I never did. And I think perhaps if I'd met him... if I'd lived in London, if I'd met him on the street and run up and said, I'm your biggest fan, I suspect I wouldn't have got the response I would have wanted because...
There's a certain distance, isn't there? And that's an interesting thing because, I mean, if a famous person receives a fan letter, as you've received hundreds of thousands of them, don't you? I mean, there is a sort of implied distance in that. And I wonder, once you start corresponding, does that distance close a bit? Do you sort of get to know each other?
It does a bit, yes, because he didn't talk down to children, and I was a child, 13, 14, 15. And some of the letters were rather fruity in tone. Oh, yes.
I'm really fascinated.
Talking about sort of having to take part in rather dreary panel games and the sort of hotel staff he had to come up against and working with some of his former colleagues. And yeah, some of the letters were quite sort of...
Were they revealing?
Slightly revealing, but quite risky as well. I mean, I sort of... I used to look at the letter and think, oh, God, I've got to show these to Mum and Dad now, because...
scary?
But they knew I was weird, so that came with the package,
but
I guess.
Tremendously exciting to be invited into an adult world, world of a famous person.
Yes,
I'm fantastic.
You mentioned a little while ago about whether it would have been right to have closed the distance fully by meeting him, and of course you nearly sort of had the opportunity. Can you say what happened?
Yeah, well, my cousin Richard in Glasgow was a big fan of Round the Horn, Beyond I Ken. So I wrote a letter to Kenneth to say, would you mind sending me a signed photograph for Richard? Yes, absolutely, no problem, I'm sure it'd be fine. So got a letter back with a signed photograph for Richard and an invitation to a book launch in London in the envelope. And I thought, oh, my God, he's inviting me to a book launch in London. What am I going to do? How am I going to get there? What am I going to wear? How am I going to get the day off school? I mean, this is sort of...
it's an event.
I've got an invitation to a book launch. So wrote back, said, dear Kenneth, delighted to get the letter and photograph and fantastic invitation to a book launch. I'm looking forward to meeting you. Sent the letter off, thought no more about it. A few days afterwards, I came back to lunch because I was at sixth form and I was studying only a few minutes away. Mum and Dad were looking rather sheepish at the dinner table and said, you'll never guess who called the house. Because I used to put my home phone number on the letters and I said, no idea. Dad said, well, Kenneth called. I said, what, Kenneth? Kenneth?
The Kenneth?
And he said, yes, I haven't, you know, Dad picked up the phone. Hello, Kenneth, how are you? He said, I didn't invite Andrew to anything. He said, I put the invitation in the envelope with the photograph to stop the postman bending the photograph. I mean, my little face must have dropped about 3 feet. I've dined out on it a few times since, but it was a bit sort of...
heartbreaking.
What brought your correspondence to a close was the untimely and tragic death of Kenneth Williams. And I understand that you were waiting for a reply when you heard the news that he'd died.
Yes, the last reply came a month before he died. It was devastating because it was a complete bolt out of the blue hearing his news of his death on BBC local radio. And whether you believe it was suicide or whether it was whatever, I don't know. Nobody will ever know. But if you look at his diaries, know about the pain he had from his ulcer in his back... I guess some friends and family and colleagues might draw that conclusion, but we'll never know.
Hang on to them. Don't get rid of them. It's
absolutely
a great archive.
Yes, absolutely.
It's fantastic.
Thank you, Buckingham. Thanks very much. JP will be here with more of those stories soon.
And lots of them are coming in. Do keep them coming. Text us 84844, email saturdaylive@bbc.co.uk, tweet us at BBC Radio 4, hashtag Saturday Live. Now, it's hard to imagine Kenneth Williams living outside central London. He was, of course, metropolitan from his head to his toes. And John McCarthy is also in a metropolitan mood this morning as he treads the streets of Paris. Well, let's say Richard
The Metropolitan, les boulevards, the platforms, the Quai de Paris.
Merci. It is not so much the streets, more the platforms of its metro system, from where John joins us now.
I'm doing a bit of window shopping here in the centre of Paris, outside a bookshop, an English language bookshop called Shakespeare & Co., which has been something of a Paris institution since it was opened in the 1950s. Looking in the window, there's a marvellous collection of old books, mainly. And it's interesting to be standing here, because this site will often be overlooked by the busy tourist, who has got the great sights of Saint-Chapelle nearby, and of course Notre Dame, which is just across the river from where I'm standing. And I'm joined by Olivia Roussel, who is an editor of Discover Paris by Metro, a way of exploring Paris and all the locations from the famous metro stations. Which is the nearest station to here, Olivia?
Well, there's Cité, which is on the island of La Cité, and there's Saint-Michel nearby.
If we go underground, so to speak, at Cité, where would you take us next?
Well, I think we'll go on the Line 4, and we could go through Saint-Germain and Saint-Michel and all the way to Montparnasse Bienvenue, I think.
Oh, we're now on the metro. How many lines are there, in fact, in the system?
There are 14 lines and 300 stations.
Looking at the map of the metro, it does look quite confusing, perhaps compared to the London Tube map.
I think it's a question of practice. You know, you just need to travel on the different lines and only get the hang of it.
I mean, is there a difference, do you think, between the two underground systems?
It's maybe quicker, I would say, in Paris.
It's only about a minute between each stop, and then when you're above ground, it seems quite easy to find one nearby.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you could walk between them very quickly, in fact.
Now, we're heading... Where are we going to get off?
Well, I think we should get off at Montparnasse Bienvenue. People think it's called Bienvenue because it means welcome in French.
Yeah, that's what I was assuming, yeah.
Exactly, but it's actually after Fulgence Bienvenue, who was the chief engineer, started the whole metro system.
When did they start building the system?
They started in 1898.
Okay.
Yes.
So an awful lot of tunnelling is going on.
A lot of tunnelling, especially under the Seine, when they had to build Cité, because they had to partly freeze the Seine to build
freeze
the station.
The river. Wow.
Yes, they had to freeze the river with, you know, refrigeration systems and brine and things like that.
Right.
And lots of things were discovered.
Oh, we're here. Hang on. Montparnasse Bienvenue. Olivia, we're now walking from Line 4 to which line are we going to get on next?
We're going to Line 6. And it's an overground line crossing the Seine, the river, close to the Eiffel Tower. So that's where you get a view.
Fantastic. Now, one thing I've noticed, there is a bit of a maze.
Absolutely. You have to
keep moving, I think.
Keep moving and pretend you know exactly where you're going.
Okay, that's it. Okay.
Je vous chante les Brassens. Les gens qui voient de travers pensent que les bancs verts qu'on voit sur les trottoirs.
So we're now on line 6, Olivier, and there's an old gentleman just up the carriage singing what, a traditional song?
He's singing a Brassens song, who's quite an iconic French singer. You know, you either get that or Edith Piaf usually with an accordion.
One thing you notice is that it's quite a smooth ride on these trains, and also it's quite quiet. We're on rubber wheels, which is sort of not something we get on the London Tube.
Well, it's a pneumatic line, so it's quite a smooth ride compared to Line 1, for example, or Line 2. And this particular line is overground.
It's a whole different perspective. And we're high up.
You can see into people's home.
We're above the ground, going over the Seine. Oh, and my word, look, there is the Eiffel Tower. And what a perfect Parisian view. That's really wonderful. We've just emerged from the metro at the Port Dauphine station and are standing on a very wide boulevard, tree-lined. In the distance is the Arc de Triomphe, and we're standing outside, I guess, what is one of the classic entrances to the metro in the Art Nouveau style, Olivia?
Yes, it's probably the most iconic entrance by Guimard, with a fan-shaped glass awning, so it's the full show. And it's not really used because Port Dauphine is not, you know, a big station. It's on the outskirts, really, of the system, just the entrance of the Bois de Boulogne.
And, I mean, are these entrances by the architect Guimard, are they preserved? Are they well looked after?
Absolutely. Cité was a really nice example as well, because you had the nice lights. So where they could, they kept them, of course.
Thank you. I just spotted an accordion man on the another busk next to that.
Exactly.
You're going to be fighting with the old boy. We're on another metro line, and this time the entertainment is from a totally different tradition, I think. Yeah. We're now standing in the colonnade around the Church of the Madeleine, looking down towards Place de la Concorde, Assemblée Nationale, and beyond that, the gilded dome of the Les Invalides. It's a fantastic sort of spot to be. If I'm leaving Paris and I want to take something special and different, what would you recommend me to do?
You can actually find honey from beehives that actually are on the top of the Opéra Garnier. They've got these beehives, and the honey you can buy 2 seconds away from here.
So that would be very special and very different.
Absolutely.
What I hadn't realised was, until travelling around with you, Olivia, that actually by using the Paris Metro, you can see a lot more of the city rapidly, perhaps than you would if you were taking a taxi or a bus on the street.
It's a very quick and efficient way of seeing Paris.
OK, Olivia, let's take another trip on the Metro. One thing you couldn't complain about travelling on the Metro is the variety of entertainment you come across. We've had Roma gypsies singing, we've had people singing Brasson and Piaf songs, and now we've got a trio of rappers who are not only singing and bopping to the music you can hear, they're also turning somersaults. It's a full Monty.
That's John McCarthy bashing his carnet on the Paris Metro.
How marvellous. Mary has brought in pictures of the Moscow Metro.
Ooh.
And if you've ever been on the Moscow Metro, it is extraordinary. The vestibules, we'll describe it, Mary,
well,
because
they
we've
all
got the
have
pictures.
These
I'll hand
great,
them round. And other people can
long
see.
Halls and then arches each side leading to the tracks.
Beautiful.
And they, in about the 30s, they had wonderful examples of 30s architecture, and all the eminent Russian architects were employed to design. Everyone was unique to design these underground stations, and they are the most beautiful.
Artists.
This one, my favourite one, this was Mayakovsky, after the poet, and it's so beautiful. It has got fluted steel arches with dark red semi-precious stone embedded in it, marble floors.
A king's palace is what it looks like.
They were absolutely beautiful. They were supposed to be the people's palaces, and they really are. And they look after them so well.
Well, of course, if they're this beautiful, you are going to respect your environment in a way that perhaps...
Well, I go down the escalator sometimes, and they have got these light fittings with globes, and I think if this were in London, there wouldn't be one.
By the way, have you been in the subway in Manhattan? Please.
I have.
Please.
Yes.
It's a real shame. And New York has got more of the great architecture in our country than perhaps anywhere else, because it's really the oldest and the most sophisticated and the wealthiest. But it's really sad and tragic. When you see something, trust me out there, if you're listening, you must have access to this. Put it maybe on the website. Could that be
That's
done?
That's a good idea, David. Yes, we shall see whether we can get some
Do
of
it.
Those pictures.
You'll,
thank
yes.
you very much,
your
Mary,
mouth
for bringing them because they
I'm
are
so
extraordinary.
It's incredible.
Much more from Mary and Jane and David a little later. But all morning you've been sending us your experiences of writing to famous people who write back to you and who sometimes spark up a rather unusual friendship. Steve moved in with his string band, the heroes he wrote to. Andrew became pen pals, as you heard, with Kenneth Williams. And JP has more.
Yes, I haven't got much time to run through these, but a few. David, don't interrupt me this time so I can read them out. This one comes from Lynn Martin, who said she wrote to Alan Bennett when she was in sixth form because her English teacher asked her to write about why he wrote 6 monologues for a man. He replied on a postcard telling Lynn that he didn't know why he wrote them and to make it up because no one on the examining board would know either. So useful advice for those of you approaching GCSEs and A-levels at the moment. And I think my favourite has come in this morning. It's from Sarah Rumans. Obsessed with Depeche Mode, I wrote to lead singer Dave Gahan, age 12. I think she was 12. 12 rather than him. And I still have the reply, which had an illustration of a rabbit on the front and a little note saying simply, "Dear Sarah, yes, it does hurt to get your nose pierced and I don't think you should do it." Signed, Dave.
That's marvellous. I wish you'd written to
well,
me.
Well, Depeche Mode had yet to bleach their first fringe when the singer we meet next first warbled her way into the hit parade. Born in Liverpool, habitué of the Cavern, friend of John Paul, George and Ringo, she went on to become one of the most famous women singers of the 60s and then reinvented herself in the 80s as the highest paid host on British television. So famous that like Houdini, Liberace and Scarface, she's known by one name alone. It's Cilla, and these are her inheritance tracks.
Well, my very first record that I ever bought, I remember it well. I was just 13 years of age and I'd saved up my pocket money and I went out to buy Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers singing "Why Do Fools Fall in Love?" Why do they fall in love? I first heard "Why Do Fools Fall in Love" probably on Radio Luxembourg. I wasn't supposed to because it was on late at night and, you know, I should have been in bed, but no, I snuck up to listen to Radio Luxembourg. I loved it because I could sing in the same key. I mean, there weren't many girl singers round, not many English singers. And he was the first one that I could sing in the same key and I could reach the high notes and the low notes as well. It was fabulous. My family were all musical. My mother used to sing. My father played the mouth organ. My eldest brother could play the piano. My youngest brother actually was professional. So it was very musical. And I loved Bill Haley and the Comets. Fats Domino, oh. I found my 3-0 on Blueberry Hill. I love that. I still love it today. Why do they fall in love? Why does my heart skip a crazy beat? I met the Beatles the very first time at the Iron Door Coffee Club. And I'd just finished school. I was with my school friends. One of the girls, Pauline, said, "Do you fancy going to the Iron Door?" I said, "What for?" And she said, "Well, my boyfriend's in the band there and, you know, I want you to meet them." By the way, her boyfriend was George Harrison. And Pauline said to George, "I'll give Cilla a go." And, of course, I heard the immortal words from John say, "All right, Cyril, get up and show us what you can do." And I remember singing Sam Cooke's version of Summertime. And it was great. I got on really well with them and they were very funny. Pete Best, who I fancied like mad, was playing with the Beatles at the time. I did never get to meet Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, but I found out the hotel when they played Liverpool at the Empire and I asked the maid when she cleaned the room, could she give me any of the rubbish from the waste paper bins? And I did. I managed to get an out-of-date Equity card of Frankie Lyman. May have still got it because I'm a hoarder. I keep everything. All me frocks, they're all in the attic. I'm like Miss Havisham when I go up there. You don't see me for 3 days.
Pack up all my care and the woe.
I've got to hand down, I've got to go with Della Reese and Bye Bye Blackbird. Well, she was the one that most influenced me in the early days. She's got this big, bold voice, very low, and you could hear her. She didn't need a microphone. You could hear her miles and miles away. I love playing my sounds. I don't really play the sounds at home,
I play them in the gym. I've got a gym at home, so I play my sounds when I'm working out, believe it or not. Well, I only work out the weekends. I'm playing at the minute the old CDs of the Sugar Babes. The faster the pace I go, the record is fast too. So that's how I work out. I'm giving my secrets away now, aren't I? Oh, it was fabulous working on Blind Day. But, I mean, I have to say, I'm a rubbish matchmaker. Everybody that I've introduced have not turned out. And I'm not talking on television. You know, I was rubbish at it on Blind Day, really. When I used to say, oh, they'll get on, they look as if they'll get on, and the next week they hated each other. How wrong was I? It's my 50th year next year, and I'm going to be 70, so I like my holidays. I love going to Barbados, I love going to Spain, I love going anywhere that I get invited, actually. But I still like to dabble. So I still love television. I still love radio. I still love being Cilla, actually. Bye Bye Blackbird is special to me because it was my childhood. And that track, and Della Reese especially, was probably a big part in me being in this business. But for that track, I don't think I would have ever made the grade. I do go back to Liverpool, more than often than not to see the family, just to get my sense of humour back. Because they're all funny up there, without meaning to be funny. The famous Ken Dodd, well, when asked, why are there so many comedians that have come from Liverpool? And he's quick as a flash, he said, because you have to be a comedian to live there. Pack up all my cares and woe. Here I go, singing kind of low. Bye, bye, blackbird. I've surprised myself there. I haven't heard myself for a million years.
Sounds to me like Della Reese actually swallowed the blackbird. That was Cilla and her inheritance tracks.
That's great, though.
As a bank holiday present, we've made our back catalogue of inheritance tracks available for you to download. Everyone from Annie Lennox, that's A, to Benjamin Zephaniah, that's Z. Just follow the links on our website.
And we're asking our guests this morning what their inheritance track would be. Mm. Do you have one, Mary?
I do indeed. Bach's Cum Sanctum Spiritu from the B minor Mass is the most joyous piece of music ever. If you were dying, it would make you change your mind.
Jane?
Well, I wrote The Sultan's Wife to a soundtrack of Baroque music, so Marais Morin, anything by him, wonderful.
And David, we must ask you for yours.
I would think if it were to pass it on to future generations, I would say my late great friend John Lennon's Imagine.
How about you, Sean? I saw you last week, Sean, get all moist-eyed at a Welsh song. There's something about that calling to your ancestry.
Yes, Calon Lan.
Yes, that's it.
That would be the song I'd inherit, but I think the one I'd pass on would be a little bit corny, but it's Don't Give Up by Kate Bush and Peter Gabriel. Break-up music.
No, I love break-up music.
Oh, well, I would have the whole Ring Cycle and make people listen to the whole thing. It's 15 hours of suffering.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for all your emails, text messages,
yes,
thoughts
indeed.
This morning. Another Liverpool connection. As a 12-year-old, I wrote to Ken Dodd to invite him to our Jubilee Street party in 1977. Not only did he reply, insisting I should include Knotty Ash in my address, of course, a suburb of Liverpool, he arrived at our house with presents for all the children and lots of his usual jovial humour.
I got a lovely one here. This is from Sonia Turner. In 1950, I wrote to the King of Norway because I was doing an exhibition on ice to Grieg's Mourning, and I wanted to know what the Norwegian national dress was like. I was invited to the Norwegian embassy in London and loaned a beautiful Norwegian costume. I was 10 years old at the time.
Your Majesty. I want to thank you for letting me come and be here with you all. It's a very different experience for me, and your intellectuals and what it's inspired me. But I am coming back. I will be here in November. On the 9th, I open in Birmingham.
Well,
I finish in Liverpool.
All the details are on our website, and we have an email from somebody in Liverpool who's already bought her ticket for your once-in-a-lifetime tour.
Indeed.
In November.
It's November, and that's the last date is the 17th. I will be here in London at Wembley, where it all began. I want to thank you all.
Thank you very much,
thank
David
you.
Cassidy.
Wembley.
And thanks to all our guests. Sean and I will be back next week. Until then, from all of us, goodbye and a good weekend.
God bless.